Any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up?
Is the secret to enlightenment chocolate cake? I think you're...
You found me out. Sharp, very sharp.
I'm trying to not fall into nihilism.
Okay.
So, the cup, as it is there. So the ultimate truth is there is an arising, dependent, free flow form there.
Let me review that again.
Okay.
So we are trying to avoid the two extremes. Actually, while we're on that topic, I just thought of something we can expand on that. We can talk about the two extremes in a number of ways. So here in this context, we've been talking about the two extremes in terms of our philosophical view. And so the two extremes in terms of our philosophical view is existence and non-existence. And of course, existence here is grasping on to independent existence, that things exist independently. And for us, of course, now there's just two possibilities, that things are like this because that's what they appear to be, or if they don't exist, then nothing exists. So therefore, often when we undermine this, we often flip to the other extreme. So what is it that helps us avoid the extreme of existence?
In regard to the person?
In terms of our philosophical view. Emptiness, yes, right. Realizing emptiness, realizing that nothing exists independently. So the antidote to this extreme is emptiness. What's the antidote, or what helps us to avoid the extreme of non-existence?
I think we still believe in the like matter energy of the universe. There's a difference between the world and the dream. In the dream, the concepts don't have any material substratum, and I think out here in this world, there's material substratum that we chop up into pieces. So there's no thing until we make things, but there's a material substratum. Is that how we duck it?
Not really. Not really. That may be according to the Vaibhashika Sautrantika school.
I guess the material is not necessarily the material. It's constantly changing.
Yeah.
And that's why you cannot say that it's a definitive material, because sometimes it's one kind of substance, the other time it's a different kind of substance. Mm. So there's something there, right?
Yeah, but what is the antidote? What avoids the extreme of non-existence or nihilism here?
Dependent arising.
But while we're on talking about the two extremes, and I'm going to come back to this to add a bit more, but before we go there, I want to take the opportunity to talk about two extremes in other areas in Buddhism. The next one is in terms of meditation.
Is dependent arising up there? Are you saying that's a realization or just an analysis?
Well, of course, we can come to an intellectual appreciation of this, but the real antidote, of course, is when we realize dependent arising.
It's a separate realization from realization of emptiness?
Yeah, so it's a good point. So when we looked at this topic, we sort of came to the idea that emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of the coin. But actually, it said that we will first come to realize emptiness directly, and because of that, then we we will realize dependent arising directly because of that direct realization of emptiness. Meditation. So what are the two extremes in meditation? And particularly here I'm talking in the context of shamatha practice. What are the two extremes or faults that we're trying to overcome?
Got
Sounds like we're caught up in the second extreme there, huh? Dullness. Or, of course, generally... the technical word that's used here, often you won't see distraction, but excitement, because that's the most common form of distraction. And dullness, we'll see laxity. So often the two are listed as laxity and excitement. So what are the antidotes to these two? So what was mindfulness the antidote to? Was it? No.
Forgetfulness.
We forgot that one as well. Okay, yeah. Okay.
So we can be faithful and inspiration and all that.
And in the table there, it actually listed, of course, this introspection or vigilance as the antidote to this. But technically, it's not the antidote. What it is the antidote, or the antidote is to recognize these have arisen. But the actual antidote is then what we do after we've recognized they've arisen through vigilance, introspection. So what's the actual antidote to dullness, or let's say excitement or distraction? So again, it's this analogy we looked at in the text of the guitar string, too tight, too loose. So when we get distracted, often we're very tight in our focus, so we need to relax or loosen. Sometimes it's called loosen the focus. And the opposite with the dullness is we're often too loose, so we need to tighten the focus. So that's in terms of meditation. We can also talk about the two extremes in terms of conduct. And here this was exemplified by Prince Siddhartha's life. So what were the two extremes of conduct? What was the first extreme that he was in the palace?
Indulgence.
Right. And then, of course, he went to the other extreme of asceticism. How did he overcome indulgence?
Leaving home.
No, but what was the antidote?
The three sites.
He gave up.
Introspection?
It's from those four encounters. What did he come to realize?
Suffering.
Yes. Suffering or dukkha. So the first noble truth. Came to realize, of course, there is no genuine happiness to be found out there in the pleasures. How did he overcome asceticism?
Dukkha.
Yeah, but what specifically?
He reached liberation.
No, before that, remember he was following his teachers and doing this ascetic practices. And then, how did he overcome that?
Rice pudding.
What did he realize? I mean, why was he engaging in ascetic practices to begin with? because he believed that that practice was going to, he falsely understood what the source of suffering was.
Yep.
So therefore, to overcome asceticism, he understood that the source of suffering is coming ignorance. From ignorance. So he understood the second noble truth.
Oh.
And that's why he stopped his ascetic practices and instead meditated to come to realize the nature of reality, to overcome ignorance. Then we have also, and I think we already came across this earlier in the text, the two extremes in terms of abiding. What were they in terms of where we abide? What were the two extremes? I think we covered this earlier in the text. I've forgotten already. Samsara and Nirvana. Remember that? So, how do we overcome the extreme of samsara? Wisdom. How do we overcome the extreme of nirvana? Compassion in the form of bodhicitta, yes. So there's a little review on the two extremes in terms of philosophical view, meditation, conduct, and abiding. Yeah.
Why do you always add in the form of bodhicitta when you say compassion?
Yeah, because here we are talking about nirvana of solitary peace. We're striving for liberation from samsara. And someone who's doing that would also develop compassion for others. You're not going to get anywhere near nirvana with a selfish motivation and harming others. So we talked about the four immeasurables, which was the wish, in terms of immeasurable compassion, was the wish for all sentient beings to be free of suffering and its causes. But then we looked in that seven cause and effect method to develop bodhicitta, which was great compassion. So remember in there, it wasn't just the wish for them to be free of suffering. May they be free of suffering. May I cause them to be free of suffering. So it's then that is taking beginning of taking personal responsibility for others. So here what we're talking about is that sort of great compassion that is the basis of the bodhicitta. Okay, so back to your question now. We did a bit of a review there. So, therefore, what was the question again?
Well, the question is the cup, like in the ultimate truth, from the perspective like of the ultimate truth.
Okay,
is the cup?
Let me give the two truths again,
okay.
We can ask the question.
Okay.
So we have conventional truth or ultimate truth. Sometimes this is translated as relative truth. So conventional truth is simply everything that exists. And everything that exists, of course, is a dependent arising. Ultimate truth is how all of these things exist. How do all of these things exist? Is that they are empty of independent existence. So emptiness is ultimate truth.
Is emptiness the only ultimate truth?
Yes. So these two truths are not two different realities. They're not two different things. So remember, dependent arising emptiness are like two sides of a coin. So conventional truth is all the things that exist. Ultimate truth is how they exist. So ultimate truth or emptiness is a quality of all of these conventional truths. Of course, we don't realize that conventional truths are dependent arisings now. when we come to realize emptiness, we will come to realize that things are merely labeled, merely imputed. So now your question.
I think I understand that there's not a cup there unless there's someone, there's an observer. But there is a free, there is a flow of form that is constantly changing, arising and passing in that space, regardless of the observer. Is that correct?
There is a cup.
Right.
There is flow of form. Right. All these things exist. We're trying to determine how do these things exist. Is there a flow of form there independent of the observer? No. I mean, even we talk about an atom. What's an atom? Isn't an atom a concept that we've developed to explain that flow? So an atom's not a separate thing there, independent of us.
Well, how do you know that?
Hmm?
I mean, we have the concept. But
that's right.
But how do you know there's not a real object out there that it applies to?
Because, that applies to, exactly. So there's a basis of designation and the designated object. But the basis of designation only comes into existence dependent on the designation. You can only have this as the basis of designation of cup if you have cup. Otherwise, it's like you can't have part of a cup without the idea of cup, can you? Can you? You can't say this is part of a cup without the idea of cup.
Right, right.
So you can't have basis of designation without the designation. Can you? Like you can't have subject without object.
Yeah.
You can't have perceiver without perceived.
Okay.
So when we're saying, well, there's a flow of form there, but that flow of form is only existing relative to the perceiver. Yes, there's a flow of form there, just like, yes, there's a cup there. Mm-hmm. We're not arguing that. We're just arguing how does this stuff exist. So we're not arguing that there's atoms and subatomic particles and stuff that are the basis of a cup. Buddhism completely agrees with that. No problem there at all. It's how do these things exist? That's the question. So Buddhism's not saying there's no Higgs boson or quarks or something. No. How do these things exist? That's the question. In fact, in Chandrakirti, who we follow a lot in terms of the emptiness explanation, you know, we saw about the chariot, in his text there he says, we don't argue with the normal people in the common people. Because if we do, we'll lose. We don't argue about in terms of what exists. But he says we do have issue with them in terms of how these things exist. So in terms of conventional truths, Buddhism's not arguing with the physicists saying, no, there's no such thing as quarks and subatomic particles and electrons and Higgs boson. No, we don't argue with that. The argument is, how are all these things existing? And they say, Buddhist assertion is that everything's empty of independent existence. Everything is a dependent arising. This is what we need to investigate.
So everything does require an observer.
We have to be very careful here, because that sort of language implies there is this separate thing, an observer, that is needed for that. Then you end up with duality, don't you? See, it's very tricky to talk about this because we're talking about something that actually is beyond conception. We're talking about things existing in a non-dualistic way, but we're using dualistic language to describe that. So any sort of language you use is very slippery, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, for example, you know, we said, you know, is this big? We said, no, well, it can only exist relative to small.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then, you know, we say there's no duality. But then often people say, oh, that means everything's one. Mm-hmm. Is big and small one? One means identical. Is big and small one? No. That's dualistic talk. Big in the text, it literally says, not two. Things are not one. I mean, for one, you have to have two.
Mm-hmm.
It's dualistic. So to say everything's one is technically misleading. It's wrong. It's incorrect. What we can say is everything's of one nature. Everything has the same nature of emptiness, but we can't say everything's one. Because one means identical, same. Is big and small identical, the same? Are they one? No, they're not two. Not two means big and small. They're not two because they are codependent.
Not two, not one?
Yeah.
Well, not two, yeah. I mean, not two means not one, not three, not four. It means all of that, doesn't it? See, that's why we have to... Any positive statement is really a dualistic statement. That's why emptiness is the absence or empty of, negation. Non-duality, not two. That's the language we have to use because any positive language can reinforce duality. And it's technically it's incorrect. That's why, for example, we're going to come up and talk about that now in terms of the Mahayana path. If we sit down and have a direct realization of emptiness in meditation, and we come out of that, and someone says, what did you realize? You'll go, sort of it was like this. It was sort of space-like. I mean, you won't be able to explain. You can't.
Yeah.
It's impossible. So all of these instructions are like pointers, but they can't describe the thing itself because it's the opposite of our conceptual language.
Gotcha.
Yeah?
Thank you.
Okay.
So in a very real way, people are going to want to know what I've been doing, and I'm going to want to say, you know, when these things come up, that things are empty of inherent existence, and they're all, everything is a dependent arising.
Yeah, so for at a beginning level, it's useful to use this language.
And on a very... What no one's saying, so it must be wrong, but what I'm going to want to say is, it means it's all connected. You know, nothing is...
See, the thing is, again, using... I mean, connected is better than independent, but connected, that word implies there's one thing here, and there's something joining them.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Isn't that what the word connected
yes.
means? So it sort of implies there are two things there to begin with that somehow have some connection. But it's the connection which defines the end points.
So I have to go the hard way. Like
No. You can... No. All I'm saying is that it's difficult to use language that doesn't reinforce duality because our language is dualistic. So we have to try and use language that at least doesn't go that way too much. So, yeah, it's difficult, but that's all we can do. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I heard what you just said. I hope I'm not diving back into that. But going along the lines of dependent arising, like this is something that will really help me. I brought it up in our group. If we have awareness and everything is dependent arising, then reality itself has awareness built into it. As in, it's self-reflecting, and we're just part of that.
Yeah, I mean, in Buddhism, of course, what is primary is awareness. Whereas, of course, in the modern science, they've started with the assumption that what's primary is matter and energy, and they've tried to describe everything from that perspective, and they've done a good job. But from a Buddhist perspective, it's a very partial answer to reality. It only explains part of reality. And yes, I mean, in some ways, and this is when you get into more detailed discussion, you'll hear language like everything arises out of emptiness. Again, it's a little bit poetic. But, and also we have the idea that this very deepest level of our mind is the basis of samsara and nirvana. So we have this sort of language to describe that. But anyway, this is a huge, huge topic.
The discussion question number two, which was how would an experience of emptiness, are you getting to that?
If you have a question.
How would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of eating delicious chocolate cake?
Mm-hmm.
We were able to see irritating person at work and how, like, merely labeled there's nothing to kind of... Hold on. So, The delicious chocolate cake was harder to get to. I don't know if that's just because attachment to the chocolate. But,
yeah.
Like, do you, like, with an experience of emptiness, things are still delicious.
Correct.
Just
correct. I'm good you came to that conclusion. And not that that somehow the chocolate cake would be tasteless.
Right, no, because we can't. It's like if water has wetness, it's still there. The property's still there. It's just not the attachment to it.
Yeah, and so what would that mean in a practical sense? Because, I mean, you, for example, you would be also self-grasping would be absent. There'd be no me. There's no me that wants to eat this chocolate cake. There's no grasping onto the me. So how would that affect then when you're actually eating it?
It seems like then you could actually truly enjoy it.
There we go. Because you wouldn't have this me needing that chocolate cake. I got to have it and I got to, you know, then this sort of fast eating and eating too much and worried about not getting enough and then somehow thinking, well, actually, this is not as tasty as last time. It's not as good as before. All of this sort of stuff. All of that will be gone.
Okay.
You would just simply enjoy, and you'd be focused, and you'd just enjoy the taste for what it is. Okay. So I think you'd probably enjoy it a lot more than you'd normally
do.
Would
you enjoy your annoying colleague? Huh?
No, what would happen? If you would just spontaneously feel compassion for them.
Yeah.
You just have spontaneous compassion because you'd see they're screwing up their life, really. They're really making a mess of their life. They've obviously got some mental afflictions and they're creating suffering for others. I mean, you would just spontaneously have compassion. Even if they were directing some very strong negative language toward you, you wouldn't take it personal. You just see this person's messing up their life. You would just have compassion. Again, the assumption was that the effect of the experience of emptiness was still affecting the mind. Of course, if we have a little experience of emptiness, we come out of the meditation, it may affect our mind for a few minutes and then it wears off. So I wasn't talking about that case. I was talking about the case where we've realized emptiness and that is still affecting our mind. It would mean then, of course, that experientially we're not seeing any boundary between us and anyone else. Experientially, we're not grasping onto this me, 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 me here. Experientially, we would see everything is interdependent. And experientially, we would see that this person is suffering and creating a lot more suffering for themselves. And so it would be like, because there's no boundary, someone else suffering is like us suffering. And so we would have just automatic compassion. It's like the example, you know, an analogy to that is, you know, that if you've got a thorn in your foot, the hand doesn't go, well, that's not my problem, you deal with it. I mean, the hand will just, you just pick it out, wouldn't it? No? Because if you leave it in the foot, they'll get blood poisoning and then the hand also suffers. Well, if you have really low self-esteem and self-hatred, you're probably not going to get to this experience of emptiness to begin with. I mean, you need a sort of minimum level of well-being to even get anywhere near this point. So it's a bit of a moot question, I think. But if we did really have the realization of emptiness, then we would, I mean, again, it's just like we see suffering. Whether it happens to be in this body in the mind or another body in the mind, it's just suffering, and we would just have compassion for that. It's not like it's my suffering or it's their suffering. We see that, and there's just automatic compassion.
So is it possible to get a direct experience of emptiness without having compassion?
I don't think so. Direct? No. To have some little taste of it in meditation? Possible, but I think to get to that point of a direct realization, you need a lot of stuff coming together to support. And I think without that sort of thing, I think from everything I read, I think it would be impossible. It would be impossible. But that's just my own... Yeah.
So, I mean, the question was something less than a direct realization, though. It was that you experienced something like emptiness in meditation.
And it was still affecting the mind, yeah.
So, I guess, you know, my question is, I understand the compassion answer, but couldn't also the answer, let's say you up the ante, and it's not just mildly irritating behavior, let's say they're poking you with a sharp stick.
Right.
Okay, so could you not experience the irritation without aversion? In other words, like, well, say, hey, this
irritation, but irritation is a form of aversion. I mean, if someone's poking you with a sharp stick, what are you directly experiencing? You're experiencing some sensations. That's it.
That's it.
That's it. That's all you're experiencing, isn't it?
But how is that different than the delicious cake? That's also just...
sensations, pleasant sensations, which you can enjoy. These are probably unpleasant sensations, but they're just sensations. So here then, if we have this, we would have these sharp sensations and we would somehow realize maybe if they've got some sharp implement that's going to damage this body. So we don't want the body to be damaged. So let's stop that. And also understanding that that person has obviously got some mental afflictions and so forth, and they're just creating harm for themselves and others. So let's stop them from doing that harmful behavior. So we can do all of that without irritation or aversion or anger or whatever. It's just seeing... I mean, it's the same like if someone is really verbally abusing us in a very heavy way, what's really happening is all that's happening is some sound waves are touching our eardrum very lightly. That's it, isn't it? Nothing more than that. I mean, are they really harming us? I mean, if they're shouting loudly, they could be damaging the eardrum, then maybe physical harm. But other than that, what harm is there? No harm.
It seems like what you're describing, though, is the absence of aversion, which is what
correct.
You're saying. In other words, you can acknowledge it as irritating. This is
irritation is aversion.
Yeah.
It's only irritating if you have aversion. I mean, if someone is really verbally abusing us, it's just some sound waves hitting the eardrum. I mean, depending on how we interpret it, we could be full of bliss because they're praising us, or full of anger or irritation because they're saying something nasty. We interpret those sound waves in that way. We create the irritation, the anger, or the bliss or from interpreting that as praise. That's what we do.
I'm trying to create equivalency between the negative and the positive, and
yeah.
I see that there isn't one.
Of course, if, again, we with anything like that, we have to evaluate whether it's harmful or beneficial and then respond accordingly. And if they're engaging in harmful behavior, we, with compassion, try to help them. If they're engaging in virtuous behavior, we can rejoice and be happy about that. Okay, let's go back into the text now to finish off this section. So we are now... down the middle of page 43, how to eliminate obscurations by becoming accustomed to those views. It says, after you have seen that the self and that which belongs to the self lack even the slightest particle of intrinsic nature, you can accustom yourself to these facts, thereby stopping the reifying view of the perishing aggregates, again, this self-grasping ignorance. When you stop that view, you will stop the four types of craving explained earlier. So remember, from stopping ignorance, we stop the mental afflictions. When you stop those, existence conditioned by attachment will not occur, hence there will be an end to the rebirth of the aggregates conditioned by existence. You will attain liberation. So here, then, by accustoming ourselves to this understanding and realization of selflessness or emptiness, we can overcome the ignorance, thereby overcome the mental afflictions, and thereby suffering, and achieve personal liberation, achieve nirvana. But then it goes on to say, what are the cognitive obscurations in this prasangika system? So remember, the cognitive obscurations is what's stopping us from achieving enlightenment. So it says here, certain latent propensities, so this was these latencies of ignorance give rise to are firmly set in the mind stream through its being beginningly suffused with strong attachment to things regarding as intrinsically existent. So remember, this is a side effect of this ignorance and mental afflictions. That these latent propensities give rise to errors of dualistic appearance. So remember, this is like a filter that means that when we perceive objects, they appear to exist independent of us, this mistaken dualistic appearance, so that things appear to be intrinsically existent when they are not. These errors are cognitive obscurations. So this is what we need to eliminate to go on from nirvana to enlightenment. And we're going to have a look now at how to do that. So let's now have a look at how to cultivate out this insight that will lead us to nirvana enlightenment. Right down the bottom, there's an outline, the presentation of our own system, which begins on top of page 44, which says, you must find the view of selflessness. So remember, here in this Majjhimika system, selflessness is another word for emptiness. Mere understanding is not enough. So again, intellectual understanding of emptiness is not enough. When sustaining the view, you must remember it and analyze it, and you must meditate on what you have analyzed. In order to do that, you must have both forms of meditation, non-analytical stabilization on the meaning and analysis with discriminating wisdom. So here that means we need both of these types of meditation. We need the stabilizing meditation and the analytical meditation. We need the stabilizing meditation so that we can have a calm, clear mind, so that when we can engage in analysis in a very good way. And then when we come through to the completion of our analysis and come to understand or realize the meaning not finding this independent me, then to hold that, which we have the discovery of not finding, to hold that again with this stabilizing meditation.
That's what they mean by sustaining the view. When sustaining the view is holding that.
To hold that in meditation. Yes. Yes. And there we can look at the next paragraph. It talks more about this. It says to achieve the non-conceptual sublime wisdom. So this again is a direct realization of emptiness. You alternate, one, developing certainty, profound certainty, that there is not even a particle of true existence in anything or non-thing whatsoever, and two, stabilizing your mind on the conclusion thereby reached. So we alternate the two, and we can continue on. It talks a bit more about this. You cannot achieve such wisdom by simply constricting mental activity without any analysis of an object. This is because it is merely not thinking about true existence. It is not knowledge of the absence of true existence. Therefore, you must distinguish between, one, not thinking about true existence, which is another word for inherent or independent existence, and two, knowing the lack of true existence, remembering this critical point. So again, simply developing a non-conceptual mind, which we can do through shamatha practice, is not realizing emptiness. So simply having a non-dualistic mind is not a realization of non-duality. So we can go on to the next paragraph. It says, in order to develop that sort of wisdom at a higher stage, your meditation must now precisely analyze the object of the conception of self, which of course is the independent self, and realize that it does not exist. So again, this is the object of negation. Therefore, although this is conceptual, it is a cause which is very conducive to the non-conceptual sublime wisdom, which means that initially, when we come in our investigation to realize that there is no independent me, then we are to hold that conclusion with this stabilizing mind. But that at that stage, it's still conceptual. There is still a sense of me coming to this conclusion and holding this absence of independent me. But this is conducive, or it's going to lead us to the non-conceptual state. So then if we go on to the next paragraph, it says, you alternate between stabilizing meditation and analysis with discriminating wisdom. If stability decreases due to excessive analytical meditation, do more stabilizing meditation and restore stability. As stability increases under the influence of extensive stabilizing meditation, if you lose interest in analysis and thus fail to analyze, then your ascertainment of reality will not become firm and powerful. Therefore, cultivate a balance of serenity and insight by doing extensive analytical meditation. So what this is saying is that we need to alternate, that if we do too much analysis, our mind destabilizes, and then we need to stop for a moment to stabilize the mind. But then, of course, we need to, once the mind is stable, we need to go back in to analyze again, to come to understand, and then hold that with stabilizing meditation. So there's this alternating going on. But then it goes on to say in the next paragraph, once you develop pliancy, it is genuine insight. So here it says, pliancy is also induced by a previously attained and continuing serenity. So insight is not simply a matter of having pliancy. What is it? Insight is when the power of analytical meditation itself is able to induce pliancy. So what does this mean? And now we'll go to our Mahayana path chart and we'll have a look at that. So here, this is the Mahayana path to enlightenment. We see that it is divided into five stages called the five paths. The first one is path of accumulation, then path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of no more learning. To enter the Mahayana path, of course, we see number two is this uncontrived renunciation and bodhicitta. So the entry point into the Mahayana path is really when we have this uncontrived bodhicitta aspiration arising. Path of accumulation, the word accumulation here, remember again, is talking about accumulating the two accumulations of merit and wisdom. So here we are accumulating both merit and wisdom, meaning wisdom, we are meditating on emptiness. Merit, we are doing a lot of virtuous activities and helping others as much as we can. Here at the path of accumulation, then we are doing as it's mentioned in the text here with our emptiness practice. We are, by the time we have entered the path of accumulation, we have achieved shamatha, so our mind is very stable, and then we do this alternation. We investigate. If our investigation destabilizes our mind too much, we go back to stabilizing a little bit and so forth, so alternating. And then we can come to an experience of emptiness, but this is not what is here called insight yet, because insight only comes when we can join shamatha and vipassana together, when they become unified. So now we are having to alternate shamatha vipassana. But as we progress along the path of accumulation, as it's mentioned here in the text, then at some point, rather than the investigation destabilizing the mind, it will enhance it. And actually through our investigation, we now again generate this physical and mental pliancy, and then shamatha and vipassana become unified. That is number four here, where we move to path of preparation. So number four is union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. So this is what's referred to here in the text whereby we our analysis induces pliancy. Then they become unified. This is called the wisdom arisen from meditation observing emptiness. But here on the path of preparation, so this is a deeper realization of emptiness because they're unified, but it's still conceptual. So even on the path of preparation, there's still a sense of a me realizing this emptiness. But because shamatha and vipassana are unified now, this realization, even though it's conceptual, has a very profound impact on our mind. So much so that outside of meditation, the power of that realization can really subdue the mental afflictions or keep the lid on them. Meaning that in daily life, because of the power of that realization, it's very hard for mental afflictions to come up. And if they come up, they're very weak and they last a very short time. But still, we're not eliminating any mental afflictions. It's only through the power of our conceptual realization that there is no conditions now for those mental afflictions to arise.
Conceptual realization is number one.
Well, conceptual realization is all the way along here. But when we talk about actual insight, insight only comes when that conceptual realization is when shamatha vipassana are unified, which is only happens at the beginning of path of preparation. So now we have insight into emptiness, but conceptual insight, not direct. Yeah.
When you say we're unified, does that mean that we've completed this and we're doing that thing?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah. yes, that's right. You need shamatha.
Okay.
As the basis for this unification. But by the time we enter into the Mahayana path, we have achieved that. So when we say this is the entry point of the Mahayana path, it's not like the starting blocks.
Apparently not.
No. These are just five easily identifiable stages. At the beginning, of course, where we're at is not so easily identifiable, and there are not really clear milestones. But we will make huge progress even before we enter the Mahayana path. I mean, if you're into the Mahayana path, if someone actually just begins the Mahayana path and people saw them, they would think that from our perspective, they'd look like they're enlightened,
right.
Really.
Right.
Because they're so much more advanced than we are. Right. So the beginning of Mahayana path is not the beginning of beginning of our journey. So we should forget this idea. I mean, okay. If we get there, we're already a long way down the path.
I heard that some bodhisattva can realize emptiness before they even commit to the bodhicitta.
Yeah, that's this number one here. It says inferential realization of emptiness. The number one should be a little line just before number two. And it says sharp faculty trainees. And that's exactly the point, is that we, of course, you know, we'd maybe like to know that if enlightenment is possible before we put a lot of effort into it. So therefore, we would investigate this emptiness and come to an inferential realization of it, and then we would have confidence that this is possible. So someone of sharp faculty would use that approach. They would put a lot of effort into coming to inferentially realize emptiness, and then they develop confidence that the path can lead them to enlightenment. Then they go on to develop bodhicitta. Whereas other trainees can work on fully developing bodhicitta, and then on the path of accumulation, they would come to this conceptual realization of emptiness. So both possibilities. But someone who's very sharp-minded probably would go that way first, because they would want to know whether enlightenment's possible before they take a lot of effort into it. That's what this means, number one there.
This inferential realization is the same as the
conceptual. But it's not the same as path of preparation, because we haven't unified shamatha vipassana yet before the path. But it is a inferential realization of emptiness, so it's conceptual, but it's not what we call here insight. Insight only begins at the point where shamatha vipassana get unified. Then, on the path of preparation, the word preparation means we're preparing for our first direct realization of emptiness. So here on the path of preparation, we are continually meditating on emptiness and we're deepening that experience. So up until this point, again, the realization of emptiness is conceptual. So there's a sense of me, the meditator, realizing this emptiness. So there seems to be this sort of gap between me, the meditator, and emptiness, the object that I'm realizing. But on the path of preparation, this apparent gap or distance between me, meditator, and emptiness, the object, starts to collapse. And eventually it will completely collapse. At that point is when we enter the path of seeing. At that point, our conceptual realization becomes a direct realization of emptiness. So path of seeing here, seeing means seeing directly emptiness. Realize emptiness directly. So number seven there, you'll see initial direct realization of emptiness, Arya. So remember, someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness now becomes an Arya being. So there's an ordinary practitioner and an Arya practitioner. And since we're on the Mahayana path, then on the path of accumulation and preparation, we were a bodhisattva. Now we become an Arya bodhisattva. Now this direct realization of emptiness, again, in the experience, the direct realization of emptiness, there's no sense of me, the meditator, versus emptiness, the object. There is just the experience of emptiness. Now that direct realization of emptiness is strong enough to start to wipe out the mental afflictions, ignorance and the mental afflictions. Before, it was only strong enough to sort of keep the lid on the mental afflictions. Now we start to wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions. But one realization of emptiness is not enough to wipe out all ignorance and mental afflictions. Only what's called the intellectually acquired mental afflictions. We see that number eight, it says abandoned intellectually acquired afflictive obscurations. So this is any mental afflictions that are based on false intellectual understanding. This is very easy to get rid of. It only takes one direct realization of reality to wipe that out because it's not very strong. It's easy. It's just gone. Then, of course, we need to continue to work on emptiness. We need to continue to realize emptiness directly again and again and again and keep wiping out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions. This is what happens on the next stage, path of meditation. Here the word meditation, again, meditation is coming from the Sanskrit word bhavana. And bhavana means to familiarize or cultivate. So what are we doing on the path of meditation? Is we're familiarizing ourselves with the direct realization of emptiness that we first gained on the path of seeing. So on the path of meditation, we are doing this. And then path of meditation here, you see, is divided up into nine parts. And together with the path of seeing, this is called the 10 grounds or 10 bhumis in Sanskrit. And on these various levels, through our continuing realization of emptiness, we are wiping out more and more subtle levels of ignorance and mental afflictions. Until we get to the end of the seventh ground here, and we see number nine, it says Nirvana Arhat. So by the end of the seventh ground, we have wiped out all ignorance, all mental afflictions, and therefore all suffering. We have gone beyond samsara. We have achieved the goal of nirvana. So we have got rid of all the afflictive obscurations. But since we're on the Mahayana path and our goal is enlightenment, then nirvana is like a byproduct that we have on the way. What's left is the cognitive obscurations, which are these stains in our mind that are causing this mistaken dualistic appearance. This is very difficult to get rid of. This is what, so even an arhat when they look out on the world appears to be independent of them. But because they've realized emptiness, of course, they know that these appearances are deceiving them. They never buy into them, so they never cause a problem. But they're still there. So they have to go on over the 8th, 9th, and 10th ground through continuous realization, continuing realizations of emptiness to wipe out these subtle stains, these cognitive obscurations. So then at the end of the 10th ground, they sit down for the very last time in meditation and wipe out the last subtle stain of ignorance in their mind. In the next moment, they become enlightened, and in the next moment, all the conventional phenomena appear to them. So an enlightened person is realizing emptiness directly and seeing the conventional world at the same time. Before that, we have to alternate. Either we're in meditation realizing emptiness, or we're seeing the phenomenal world that appears to be in a dualistic. So we alternate, but when we get to the point of enlightenment, we wipe out that last subtle stain, then that an enlightened person is realizing the emptiness of phenomena and seeing the phenomena simultaneously. So this is the fifth stage, the path of no more learning. We've become enlightened. So the Arya Bodhisattva becomes an Arya Buddha. So any questions about the chart here? Yeah.
Is there any talk in the Mahayana or Vajrayana traditions about when and where Shakyamuni Buddha was, or Siddhartha was at each of these stages?
Yeah.
Was it during his final lifetime? Did he go through all 10 or
8 through 10? Yeah. Generally, I think in the Theravada traditions, or at least in the two schools, the Vaibhashika Sautrantika schools, I think the assertion is that he was at somewhere around the beginning of Path of Preparation, sat down under the Bodhi tree, and went through the whole lot in one sitting. In the Mahayana in general, but certainly in the Tibetan tradition, it's accepted that Prince Siddhartha was already enlightened and that he was just doing a display to help us. So that person was already an enlightened person who was appearing in the form of a prince and so forth, and it was just a display to help people understand what to do. So this is generally, certainly in Tibetan tradition, but I think in general in Mahayana, the assertion. And that comes down to the next point I want to cover. But before I do that, maybe some more questions.
We talked a lot about the training in emptiness, but what about the compassion side? Should we also be training in like the six perfections simultaneously?
Yeah. So here, of course, we see in the first six grounds, generosity, ethics, patience, joy, effort, concentration, wisdom. Of course, there's a lot more to talk about this, but what we're saying is that each of those stages, we are emphasizing that particular practice. But, of course, all the time, we're practicing the six perfections within the six perfections.
So we're trying to build
all
up,
the time.
We're trying to build up emptiness,
Yeah.
At the same time, we're building up the six perfections.
Yeah.
At some point
What is it that makes our emptiness realization more powerful along the path of meditation? It's not emptiness. We're not realizing something more subtle. It's the same realization all the way along. Why is it more powerful and it can wipe out more and more subtle? Because of this, because of the bodhicitta and the merit and all the virtuous activities. Without that, we'd be stopped.
The two wings.
Exactly. So what makes that direct realization of emptiness more powerful is this.
Okay.
That's why we can keep moving along. It's not like we're realizing something more and more subtle along the path. We're not. It's the same realization of emptiness.
But then you were like a perfecting generosity, that means the extreme generosity, right? And then so then you move to the next stage, it's like you already perfect.
Yeah. At that point it says we've perfected generosity. Of course we still practice it. Yes, of course. We don't stop doing it. Oh, I've done the generosity thing now. Finish with that. Let's do something else. No, it's not like that.
Automatic. After that it becomes automatic.
I kind of wonder, like, there must be a reason you teach this. There must be a reason you follow it. It looks so far away to me that I think, like, why am I studying this? I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
No. So, but I mean, there must be a reason, right, that you study it and teach
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, and the reason is to understand the framework, the path. I mean, of course, if we then get hung up about getting this result, then we're just going to get frustrated. So the idea here being is to see a clear framework that we can follow forward. So this, and of course we need to work where we are now.
Yeah.
But if someone were to just say to you, well, there's this thing, enlightenment, just do these practices and you'll get there. No, don't worry about how, but just do that. Uh-huh. I mean, you may think, well, what are they talking about? You know, what is this enlightenment thing? And if I do these practices, will I really get there or not? You can't see any clear path.
Yeah.
Of course, if you have a highly qualified teacher and you have a lot of faith and respect, then you may take faith from them. But again, if we can, what's emphasized in Buddhism is faith through reasoning. So if we can look at this and see whether it makes sense, then we can develop faith that, yes, okay, I'm here now, that's a long way to go, but this is, seems to be a very clearly laid out path that I can follow. I can have confidence that in the long term, I'm going to end up in a good direction. So that. Yeah. But of course, you know, if we get caught up in speculating about all sorts of things at these higher levels, then we're living in the future. That's not going to help. But it's, you know, at whatever level, if we can have a very basic understanding of the path, then we can, of course, work where we are now. So I'm just giving some brief overview.
No, and I think it does help when I think of my teacher, you know, he went through this whole, like, step by step, and it gives me more respect, right?
As well, of course, of course,
sometimes feels like, why am I studying? But I get what you're
saying. Again,
even if I won't get there in this lifetime, which hopefully I will, I know that there is a path. That
that's
people
right.
People just don't spontaneously become
enlightened. No.
Even though they seem like they do when you're around them.
So that's all it is. It's sort of to understand the progression, and it's to understand what components that we need to be working with as we move forward. That's all.
What it must be like to be you. You're receiving all this, but you're coming in and you're presenting, you know, very complex things that aren't part of our culture in a way that we can understand it.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful, and I think that this has been a real gift, and you're truly inspired. So thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions about this? Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about the union of shamatha and vipassana? So what is it that happens to the mind that you reach that union, and experientially, what does it actually look like? What does it mean?
So earlier we talked about I don't have it here with me now, the shamatha path, and we got up to that ninth level, and then there was this radical transition that through the power of our stabilizing meditation, then we had this physical and mental pliancy, serviceability or flexibility of body and mind happening as a result of that, as a result of the stabilizing meditation. And that was the transformation that brought us to shamatha. So that was induced through the power of the focus or concentration. And then, of course, we're using this very focused mind to analyze, investigate nature of reality. And, of course, every time we investigate, that will destabilize the mind a little bit. And if our mind becomes too destabilized, then we stop our analysis and stabilize again and then go back to analysis. So we have to sort of alternate a bit. But as we continue to do that, what you will notice is that at some point, rather than the investigation destabilizing the mind, it will enhance the mind and it will induce this physical and mental pliancy again. But this time, the physical and mental pliancy is induced through the investigation, not like earlier, just through the focus. And so at the point where the investigation does not disturb, but rather induces the physical mental pliancy, then they become unified. Then we can investigate with shamatha without destabilizing the mind, and that is the marks the point of the entry of path of preparation.
And you had that ability, you could use it for other items besides emptiness, I suppose, other
aspects sure. of it. Of course.
Do you mind, because this number missing, you know, this
So that was milestones. So I'll do it again. So they're numbered 1 to 10, of course.
I've got it from my own.
Okay. Yeah.
You didn't talk about the uninterrupted.
Oh, yeah, okay, well. I can. Do you want me to? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll try and keep it simple. So what we see is these sort of two shaded lines, and they're right on the change point from one level to the next. What it means is that how we move from one level to the next is always in meditation. It's always in meditation on emptiness. And the darker one, the uninterrupted path, what that means is that we're sitting in meditation, and now, due to the power of our positive actions that we've done in the last time, now the realization of emptiness that we're entering into, the direct realization of emptiness, will, without interruption, eliminate the next level of mental afflictions and ignorance. That's what uninterrupted means. This very moment is now powerful enough to, without interruption, to eliminate the next level of ignorance and mental affliction, and then in the very next moment, we have liberated ourselves from that level of mental affliction. That's the liberated path. So these two lines are literally in sort of one moment to the next. So at that point, we have eliminated the next level of the ignorance and mental afflictions, and we move to the next level because of that.
So I guess I'm curious, at what point in the Mahayana path would someone decide to take the Tantra path? In other words, I understand this is all sequential, but obviously they're not going to wait till they achieve Buddha status.
No. In fact, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Tantra Vajrayana tomorrow morning in the first session. Within Tantra or Vajrayana, where in Tantra Vajrayana, of course, we're trying to tap into that very subtle, clear light mind. According to Tantra people, you can't achieve enlightenment this way. That because this is still using the coarse mind. Okay, we refined it a lot with shamatha, but according to Tantra people, we can't get all the way to enlightenment, but we can get, like, I think, right up to the end, like the 10th ground. But those last subtle stains in our mind, according to Tantra at least, we can't get rid of using the coarse mind. Too difficult, impossible. We have to gain access to the very subtle level of our mind, the mind of clear light, to do that. But, of course, by the time we got to that level of path, then Tantra is a piece of cake. So from a Tantra perspective, we have to at some point move to Tantra to get to enlightenment. Of course, Sutra people would disagree, but what we're going to see tomorrow morning is that to effectively practice Tantra, we need a certain minimum basis.
And is there like a particular ground that you have to...
No. And of course... No. And of course... In the Tantra path, it's also explained through various stages, but it's not using this same setup because we're dealing with the very subtle clear light mind. And so therefore the stages are quite different. But of course we're still eliminating the mental afflictions and stains and so forth. But you won't see this presentation in Tantra. coincidentally, I think they also talk about five stages, but they're not sort of matching onto these five. And that's to do with how we, with the very subtle mind, we move to enlightenment. And of course, in the Tantra Vajrayana, we can, in the best case scenario, achieve enlightenment in this very lifetime. But I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow morning, along with a sort of a summary of everything we've covered so far. Yeah.
Living in the very distant future, do we have language to describe what the world would look like to see the conventional world and the non-dualistic world at the same time?
I mean, I mean, we have never had that experience.
Right.
Everything has always appeared to us in this mistaken dualistic way. So to understand how an enlightened person perceives that not in a dualistic way, I mean, it's...
Nobody wrote that down.
I mean, apart from the fact that they don't have mistaken dualistic appearance, but what that means in experience, I mean, it's... In fact, even they talk about that, and there's even in some of the high-level schools, there is a difference of opinion about how a Buddha or an enlightened person actually sees the conventional world in terms of what that really means. There's some different assertions, so there's not even a consensus of agreement there. So I think we don't need to worry about that right now. Maybe we need to focus on some other things first, perhaps. Any other questions about this chart here? Okay, then I'll just mention one more thing related to this. When we achieve enlightenment, then an enlightened person is described in terms of kayas. Often that's translated as bodies, the two bodies or the three bodies of a Buddha. So we can talk about the Dharmakaya, which is the enlightened mind. And Dharmakaya sometimes is translated into English as something like truth body or wisdom truth body. But here again, we're just talking about the enlightened mind of the Buddha. Then, of course, an enlightened person has a physical or manifestation or appearance, and this is called Rupakaya. As we saw in the five aggregates, Rupa means form. So this often is translated as something like form body. And so this is talking about how an enlightened person can appear in the world. And often this Rupakaya can be divided into two, meaning that an enlightened being can appear at two levels, in a very subtle level or a more coarse level. There is what's called the Sambhogakaya, often translated as something like complete enjoyment body. This is a very subtle manifestation of an enlightened person that only high-level practitioners can perceive. In particular, only Arya Bodhisattvas can perceive. So someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness on the Mahayana path, can perceive this subtle form of an enlightened being.
All the time, anytime?
Yeah. And then Nirmanakaya is a more coarse manifestation of enlightened being, often translated as emanation body. And so Nirmanakaya is a form that we could potentially perceive of an enlightened being. So these are the kayas or bodies of a Buddha. But again, bodies, we shouldn't think of bodies in this, particularly Dharmakaya is not any sort of physical. The Dharmakaya is actually the mind of an enlightened being. But often then you have a presentation of this in terms of an enlightened being. And of course, within the Theravada traditions, positing nirvana and enlightenment more or less the same thing, then they wouldn't talk about these sorts of things, particularly Sambhogakaya and so forth, because even someone like Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment when that body and mind, that body finished in that life, then there's no longer any more appearance in the world after that. It's finished. Whereas in a Mahayana perspective, they wouldn't agree with that. That when someone's enlightened, then the Dharmakaya exists, and then the Rupakaya, that enlightened being, can manifest in these various levels to help sentient beings in the future. Yeah.
So in the Mahayana, don't they say that Buddha can manifest in several different emanation bodies at the same time?
Yeah, yeah.
If that's the case, why don't each of us have our own personal Buddha body?
Often it's said that the restriction lies in us, our obscurations. Like, even to the point, I think, now where if someone really was enlightened and appeared in a similar way than Shakyamuni Buddha did 2,600 years ago, I think, unfortunately, in our society, they may get locked up and put in a mental asylum. I mean, seriously, yeah. I mean, if someone's often walking around in that way, often we think they're some crazy person and we sort of lock them up. Yeah. Huh? Yeah. So they often say that the limitation is from our side. It's our obscurations. And that when we become an Arya Bodhisattva, we will see these. I mean, it's there all the time.
You just can't see them.
That's right. Well, Sambhogakaya, that's right. Yeah.
I heard that the people who realize, the Iron beings can see His Highness as the
Avalokiteshvara.
Yeah, but normal people can see it. That's true.
Well, it depends if His Holiness is really enlightened or not. I mean, of course, if you ask the Tibetan community, he's Avalokiteshvara. Mm-hmm. From my side, do I know if he's enlightened? I can't tell. And if you ask him, he just says, I'm a simple Buddhist monk who can't meditate very well. And, I mean, I can see from my own experience that he's very highly spiritually advanced, but whether or not he's enlightened, I don't know. I don't know.
I've heard terms like rainbow body.
Okay. Yeah, comes in the context of Dzogchen practice in the Nyingma school, and that's a little bit related. You know, I talked about at the time of death we can access the clear light mind. So often in the Nyingma school, someone who can do that and really achieve enlightenment, their coarse material body actually just disappears. And they talk about then this rainbow body. But I've only really ever heard it within the context of the Nyingma Dzogchen school. But that's the idea. Okay. Yeah.
Kaya, there's another term that I've heard, Datu?
No.
Is that the same thing?
No, it's different. Datu is the, we looked in that list before someone asked a question about the sources and constituents or something in the earlier on in the objects of meditation, the aggregates, sources and, I think it was constituents or elements, was it? I can't remember how they translated it here in the book. That's Datu.
Okay.
Are you thinking Dharma Datu?
Yeah, but it's the Datu is the same. Oh. Yeah.
So, but not the same as Kaya?
No.
Datu, Dharma, Kaya, different things?
Yeah. I mean, they're not having the same meaning. No. Yeah.
Okay, as much as I can grasp right now, I think I do.
Yeah.
I kind of got.
Yeah.
And the fact that the Dharmakaya is
the mind.
And the rupa is of the body.
The rupa is the form.
Yeah, it's the form. It's not truly a body.
Yeah, it's not like this.
Right, but I didn't get the subtle one, which is apropos.
The Sambhogakaya. So, for example, there are beings that we can't perceive because their physical form is too subtle. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about these devas and asuras and so forth. Similarly, but not exactly the same as that, this is a very subtle manifestation of an enlightened being that only someone who's very purified their mind, an Arya Bodhisattva, can perceive. I mean, there's a lot more to talk about this, but...
But so their purpose...
is to give teachings to these Arya Bodhisattvas.
Okay.
And to help them on the way to enlightenment.
So then...
Not just there hanging out having fun.
Well, I kind of hope.
When we achieve enlightenment, we just go on holiday.
So then the coarser one can, what level, you said we could...
Yeah, I mean, potentially. I mean, when we look at this, I mean, theoretically, it's possible, for example, that I'm the only person in this room that's not enlightened. You're all enlightened, appearing as students, pretending to be students to help me. Technically, this is possible. I mean, you know. Have I caught you out? I'm quite sharp, huh? I'm one of these sharp faculty trainees. Okay, let's leave it there because I think Fabian, the director here at Vajrapani, wants to say a few words since we're coming to a close in this retreat. Tomorrow morning, of course, just to let you know now what's happening tomorrow morning, in the session before breakfast, actually Venerable Drolma is going to lead that because she's going to also give you a lot of advice about meditation practice. And then I've got two sessions in the morning. The first one is I'm going to talk a little bit about the very last points in this text about the Vajrayana Tantra, and give a little bit of a summary of the whole thing. And then in the second morning session, I'm going to give a lot of advice about other further reading and courses and retreats and a lot of other stuff and some advice about what to do when you go home and the Sangha and all of these things. So that's going to come tomorrow morning as well. So that's a little bit for tomorrow morning.